This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, The Kids Are All Right, was directed and co-written by my guest, Lisa Cholodenko. She also made the films Laurel Canyon and High Art, which won the National Society of Film Critics Award for Ally Sheedy's performance and a screenwriting award at Sundance in 1998. In The Kids Are All Right, Julianne Moore and Annette Bening play a lesbian couple. Each of the women used the same anonymous sperm donor to become pregnant. Their children are now teenagers. At the beginning of the film, after the daughter, Joni, reaches the legal age in which she is allowed to learn the identity of her genetic father, she and her brother track down the sperm donor, who's played by Mark Ruffalo. After they meet him, each member of the family is changed by him in ways they could never have predicted. Our film critic David Edelstein described the film as a situation comedy, a superb one, that shakes up our way of looking at the family. Let's start with a scene. The mothers are concerned about their son, Laser, who has been spending a lot of time with a wild male friend and has grown distant. Thinking that Laser's holding something back from them, like maybe he's gay, the mothers have a talk with him. Laser is played by Josh Hutcherson.
Your mom and I sense that there's some other stuff going on in your life. We just want to be let in.
What do you mean?
Are you having a relationship with someone?
You can tell us, honey. We would understand and support you.
Look, I only met him once.
What do you mean, once?
Did he find you online?
Wait,
what?
Wait, who did you meet once?
Paul.
Paul, who's
I met him with Joni.
Why was Joni there?
She set it up.
Forget the setup. Who's Paul?
Our sperm donor. Did you guys think I was gay?
No. No way.
Well, of course not.
That's a scene from The Kids Are All Right. Lisa Cholodenko, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you decide to write and direct a movie about a lesbian couple whose children track down the sperm donor who is their father?
I started writing it about 5 years ago, and the original idea came on the heels of my girlfriend and I had just decided to have or try to have a child with an anonymous sperm donor. And we had gone through a lot of conversations about which way to go. Do we go with a friend? Do we do this, with this anonymous person? And what does that mean? And what will that mean for the child to be in 18 years? Will he be able to find this gentleman? So I became very absorbed in these meditations on what's the life of this child that I hopefully will have, what's it going to be? And when I sat down to write an original script, I was sort of consumed with this idea. And so this sort of template for this family came out without, it was sort of unmediated. I just started writing and there they were. And there they were on the brink of their eldest child turning 18 and being of age where she had the prerogative to reach out to seek the sperm donor and if he was interested to have contact with him. So it really began there. I had a kind of interesting kismet moment when I was into the script for about a month and in walked an old friend from New York. I was in L.A. at the time, Stuart Blumberg, who, sat down and we had a conversation. What are you doing? What are you doing? And within a half an hour, I learned that he had been a sperm donor in college. And Stuart was a screenwriter and writing kind of more commercial studio movies. And before that breakfast, lunch, dinner, I don't remember what it was over, I had sort of spontaneously asked him if he wanted to co-write this script with me.
So it's great you had both points of view, the lesbian woman looking for a sperm donor and the former sperm donor.
Exactly, yes. And it was interesting because I had, been in the world of looking for a sperm donor, but I had never actually met a sperm donor. So there he was, and he was my friend. I had known him for many years.
So did you subsequently actually find a sperm donor and have a baby?
I did, yes. And, that process had begun right around the time I started the film. We had chosen someone, which was a long process for me. I had to go through every applicant that ever existed on this website. And
is that not bizarre to, have auditions for a father?
Oh, my God. It was psychedelic. I don't know how to describe what that was, but hence I made a film out of it in some way.
So you got the baby and the film.
Yes, I got the baby in the film. So we picked somebody, and I felt really confident about the guy that we picked. And we have a 4-year-old now, and he's a great kid. He's great.
So in the family that you've created for the movie, the teenage children have drifted away from their parents. And it's very, very painful to the parents to see that happen. And it's something that I think happens to so many parents. In making this movie, did you think any part of that had to do with it being gay parents, or did you just see that as being like, that's what so many families face, that the teenagers reach an age and they maybe get sullen or, annoyed with the parents, or they just want to be their own people, and in the struggle to become your own person, you forcibly reject your parents sometimes in ways that you may or may not feel bad about later in life?
Yeah, I think it was kind of two parts. You know, one was we're entering the moment of this family, you know, at a very decisive point. She's 18 and she can reach out and meet this donor. And once we decided that that was the decisive point, you know, it made it easier for us to say, well, what is the moment for each of these individual characters, knowing that the oldest child is going off to college, and what is that bringing up for each of them? And so part, I think, of the journey of writing the script was, how do we take something that's so universal to families, you know, or many, many families face this thing of their children going off to work or going off to college or moving out of the house, and how does that impact everybody? And then also to get into the psychology of each of the characters, particularly the moms. And I've had a lot of questions about Annette Bening's character, and why is she so taut, and why is she, you know, kind of rigid and seemingly on edge all the time. And, you know, for me, it makes perfect sense. She's really hung up and stressed out and upset that her baby's leaving. And she's taken it hard, and it's coming out in the strangest, most unappealing ways until, you know, toward the end of the film, where you know, she finally kind of lets her guard down, and you see what she's been keeping at bay, all that emotion that she's been kind of holding back.
So your co-writer on The Kids Are All Right was Stuart Blumberg, and he had been a sperm donor, so you had both sides of the story here, both sides of the experience. What did he tell you about being a sperm donor that you found really enlightening, both in terms of your personal experiences having used a sperm donor, but also in terms of understanding the Mark Ruffalo character who plays the sperm donor in the movie?
A few things. I think at first I was being very kind of provocative with him, and I was like, oh, well, let's, you know, call your university and see if you have any offspring. And he, you know, all the blood drained out of his face, and I could see, like, wow, that was something he was horribly afraid to discover. Like, he wasn't interested in that, or he hadn't prepared himself for a phone call like that. So I thought that that was interesting, that there would be this kind of range of reticence and fear and you know, what did that all mean? So we sort of chipped away at that reaction. So that was one piece of, you know, Stuart's experience that I think that we sort of comported to the Paul character. And then also spending time with Stuart and trying to figure out, well, who were you, Stuart, at, you know, this younger age? I don't know, it's 19 or 20, who wanted to donate sperm, and why, you know, where was your head when you did that? What was your thinking? You know, was it just financial? Was there like a higher kind of calling that you wanted to, you know, help people who couldn't have children, as Mark Ruffalo tries to tell Josh Hutcherson's character in the film? And you know, he had a lot of different responses to it that I think informed Mark Ruffalo's character. But one that was interesting was this idea that there was a real disconnect from being in the moment and being that age and doing that, and what would come to pass 18, 20, 25 years later. And I think that's a real marker of youth, that you think kind of whatever's happening in the moment, there's no sense of, you know, that there are real ramifications.
More like giving blood than giving sperm.
Right.
Have you gotten any criticism for casting two straight actors in the role of the mothers, when there's probably a lot of lesbian actresses looking for good roles?
People have asked me about it. And I keep coming back with the same answer. I feel kind of resolute that, you know, people's domestic lives, their, you know, personal lives, their non-professional lives are their lives, and their professional lives, in this case, you know, they're screen actors. That's just a different category. And I don't feel political about it. You know, if there was a great actress or actor that availed themselves to me that was gay and I felt that they could nail the part as well as Julianne or Annette or Mark, for that matter, I would have been all for casting them. But as it turns out, you know, I wanted recognizable actors. You know, I was reaching for A-list actors, which I was fortunate to get, and actors that I personally felt would be convincing and compelling in these parts, not just, you know, simply to because they could play gay and they could, you know, pretend, but that they had a lot of dimension and kind of take these roles and transcend the gender identification or the sexuality identification, whatever it was.
You know, I want to say one of the things I really like about Annette Bening is that I don't think she's had any cosmetic surgery on her face. And maybe she has, but she looks like she's aging naturally. And I think it makes her so attractive. You know, I just really respect so much women who are able to have a career in something like the movies without having to undergo the knife in order to do it. And I understand why women do it. I understand the pressures that they're under. But to say no to that, as I think she has, I think is really tremendous.
I hear what you're saying, and I think it's true. I think it's one of the things that on some level repelled me from other actors that I may have considered at some point in this process. I felt like, particularly in this family where I feel like what I want to get at is how authentic and how real and how relatable these people are, that this is not, you know, one of those Hollywood movies where people are going to be, you know, Botoxed and pinched, and these are real people. And what's going to be attractive about them is that they're soulful and, you know, that they are aging gracefully and that they are, you know, self-possessed. I think that that's really the key. I think that implies a person who can embrace themselves and still feel sensual and powerful.
Now, your first feature-length film, High Art, do you want to give the two-sentence description of it and spare me having to condense it like that? Can I make you do it?
I can try. I haven't pitched it in a while, but it's about a young woman who's an aspiring magazine editor and finds herself in Manhattan in the kind of in the thick of the art scene. It's set in the late 90s, and she discovers through a plumbing accident the neighbors upstairs and a woman named in the film, Ally Sheedy, Lucy Berliner, who's kind of been a very prominent photographer in the New York art scene and has since kind of fallen into seclusion and is heavily involved in a drug scene.
And is lovers with a German actress.
And is lovers
Greta,
with a German.
Yeah.
Right.
Who's played by Patricia Clarkson. And what I think was Patricia Clarkson's first big role, at least it's the first time I saw her.
Yeah. It probably was her first, like, sort of major featured role. I know she had been in a lot of big films, but as very sort of supporting characters. And she had also done a stint on a television show, and I don't remember the name.
Well, she was so good in this role, I was sure that she was German, which,
Others,
of course, she's
yeah.
not. Yeah.
No, so, she's definitely not.
So let me play a scene from High Art, because I think Patricia Clarkson and Ally Sheedy give such really good performances that are really different roles for them. So in this scene, they're having a fight, because Patricia Clarkson has nearly OD'd. She was rescued in part by the young editorial assistant who wants to get Ally Sheedy into the magazine that the editorial assistant writes for. And Ally Sheedy clearly is attracted to her. And Patricia Clarkson is aware of that attraction and I'm very jealous of it. So here's the scene, and Ally Sheedy talks first.
You don't know when to stop, G. You have no limits. You get a really clean bag and you keep kicking it back till you go unconscious.
Tell that Sid to stop coming around. She's a little psychophant.
A psychophant? What is that? I don't know what that is.
You know what that is. She's a bootlicker. A parasite.
She saved your
white. Joan threw me in that tub and I wasn't dying anyway.
When I came into that room, you weren't breathing.
She's f***ing you off. You're so wrapped up in her, you can't even see it. She comes in here all cocky and eager. She doesn't know f*** about her. She's a teenager.
Credo, would you just... would you eat that? Please?
That's a scene with Patricia Clarkson and Ally Sheedy from the film High Art, which was written and directed by my guest Lisa Cholodenko, who also made the new movie The Kids Are All Right. So what made you think of casting Ally Sheedy and Patricia Clarkson? Patricia Clarkson was so new to film, and Ally Sheedy was known as this former teenage star and had kind of dropped out of sight for the most part.
It was one of those things that there was never any kind of preconception about who could play these parts. I wrote the film when I was actually still in film school. I was in graduate school, and I was just, you know, kind of busy writing away. And then when I finally had the opportunity to make it, I was for the first time thrown into a casting process, and I had obviously never done that. I was, you know, a student. So I was working with a casting director, and people were coming in and reading for me. And, you know, I read amazing actors, but nobody had sort of nailed it for me. And the casting director came in one day and said, you know, I got a call from Ally Sheedy, and she called me herself, and she wants to fly herself to New York to read for you. She's in L.A. And are you open to that? And I sort of scratched my head, and I said, that seems so weird. Really? There was a certain part of me that thought, well, that would be interesting. I mean, she's a known actor, but all I could think of was The Breakfast Club. It just seemed weird. And I hadn't really followed her career or anything since then. And it also seemed like, was it going to take my film in another direction? And, you know, I had a whole host of anxieties. I mean, making that decision to cast somebody in a lead role is, you know, it's a big one. Anyway, I got home that night and there was a phone call from Ally herself. She called me and said, look, you know, I feel like this is my life. This is an experience I have gone through. And this, I feel like you wrote this for me. I was like, well, I'm glad you feel that way. I didn't. You know, and she said, well, I feel like that, and I'm going to put myself on a plane, and I'm going to be there, you know, tomorrow or whatever. And she did it. And she just hustled to New York, and she walked in, and she read some scenes to me. And, you know, against sort of my resistance, because I was really predisposed to not casting her, I felt like, oh, you do know this. This could have been written for you. And it was kind of one of those things where it was like a stunning audition. It just, there just wasn't a question for me. And I just said, okay.
Which was the part of the story that she had lived?
She had been in her younger life involved with rock and roll guy, and had developed a dependency on a kind of heavy sedative. And, you know, her friends were concerned about her, and there was an intervention, and they sent her to Hazelden. And this is all documented. I think she wrote a book about it and had gone, you know, to rehab. And so felt like, you know, this whole episode of getting dependent on this drug, and then kind of feeling like she'd become a drug addict and an intervention, and then cleaning up, and how it had affected her reputation and whatnot, really had stayed with her, and she felt like it was a really defining thing in her life. So I think she brought that experience to the role.
And what about Patricia Clarkson?
You know, Patricia, I had no knowledge of Patricia Clarkson. I looked at her resume and stuff, and I don't think I had seen her in anything, television or any of the larger features that she had supporting roles in. But I was in a place where we got the financing together, and everybody's dates were kind of coming due. You know, actors had committed to certain times, and it's hard to get everybody on the same page at the same time making a film. And I still hadn't cast that role, that Greta role. And I was on the brink of having to cast somebody that I didn't feel was really right for it. And I was kind of panicking, and I said to the casting director, you have to pull out all the stops. We have to have like an emergency casting session. And this fellow, Carrie Barton, who was just so supportive and generous, spirited, and just would go the nine yards, said, come in tomorrow. I'll have, you know, people here for you to read. And I walked in, and Patty Clarkson was sitting there, and she you know, read some scenes to me, and my jaw just dropped. I was just flabbergasted at how awesome she was. Qualities that you wouldn't expect in the same person, you know, or that somebody could merge into the same character in a performance. And she was so tragic and kind of comic at the same time. It was stunning, and it wasn't at all what I had written. I had, like, missed something that it was absolutely necessary for that character to have, and Patty just brought it instinctively.
You started your professional film career working as an editor for John Singleton on his movie Boys in the Hood. How did you get to work on that movie?
Well, I have to correct you and say I started my career working as an apprentice editor. It was my first experience in the cutting room. So I went on to become an assistant editor and worked on other studio features before heading off to film school. In terms of the John Singleton experience, I was kind of deciding that I wanted to find my way into a career in film, and had a friend that was one of the producers on that movie, and she managed to get me into the cutting room. It was a kind of a seminal experience for me, particularly because I was, you know, working so closely with this young guy who, he was 24 at the time. He was right out of USC Film School, you know, who not only had made this major feature film for, I guess at the time it was Columbia Pictures, but you know, had been given the money to do so based on a script that he had written, but also had written something that was entirely personal about, you know, his community from a very heartfelt and kind of singular perspective. And I think in some way that that had a large influence on me. I saw that, you know, while John Singleton's world and his experience was quite different from my own, that it was possible that a person take their experience, and if you have enough passion and enough stomach for it, that you can actually get to the point where you can make a film from it and many people go see it.
We're living in a time now where coming out is really easy for some people because things have changed so much, but is really, really hard for some other people because, depending on where you live and what your family is like and what your religion is, coming out can be very, very difficult. You can really sacrifice a lot. Was coming out a big deal for you, or were you able to do it pretty easily?
You know, I'm in my mid-40s now, and I came out when I was in, I guess, like 11th grade, so I must have been like 17, and so that's quite a long time ago, and the, you know, the temperature and the culture was different, and I was young. So it was fraught for me in the sense that, you know, I was in high school and there weren't other people who were gay that I knew, and so I felt different and confused about that. But I had a great love affair in high school, you know, let myself have that love affair and tried to keep it kind of to myself. But I come from a very talkative and inquisitive and pretty liberal Jewish family in a pretty liberal place, Los Angeles. And I sort of was eventually kind of outed by my mother, who kind of took me aside one day and said, you know, well, it's obvious to me you're in love with this person and, you know, you're struggling to kind of sort it out. So why don't you go get some therapy and, you know, feel better about it, because I don't want to
feel better about it, not get some therapy and change.
Right, right, right. Just, you know, as your Jewish mother, it's hard to see you struggling, that kind of thing.
Did you seek therapy?
I did. It was great. And I was happy to go see my therapist every week. It was, what year was that? That was, you know, in the early 80s, and it was just a different time. I'm really glad that, you know, the culture is changing and that there's so many more places for young people to, you know, be out and meet other young people who are out, and that there's much better feeling about it and exposure. And that's when people grapple with their sexuality. So, you know, I think we have to embrace everybody. It wasn't that I wasn't being embraced. It just was that it just wasn't a time when people felt like they could be exposed.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. It's an honor. Thanks.
Lisa Chulodenko directed and co-wrote the new film, The Kids Are All Right. When you turn up the air conditioning or turn on your computer, you may not think much about where the electricity we use comes from, but Joel Achenbach does. In the July edition of National Geographic, he writes about the problems with the nation's electric grid, a patchwork of more than 5,000 power plants connected by 150,000 miles of high-voltage transmission lines. Much of the technology is outdated, and the grid is prone to breakdowns. The massive East Coast blackout of August 2003 is widely remembered, but smaller, more frequent power outages cost the economy about $80 billion a year. And the clumsy grid we have is unfriendly to renewable energy resources. Joel Achenbach is a staff writer for The Washington Post. He's written 5 books and has a monthly science column in National Geographic. He spoke to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Joel Achenbach, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, we all know there are these power lines all over the country, but most of us don't know much about the grid. And I think we have the idea. We all have a local utility company, and every month they send us a bill to tell us how many kilowatt hours we've used. And so we picture them generating that power from the local dam or nuclear power plant or coal-fired power plant and then just zapping that electricity over a relatively, you know, short distance to our homes. Give us a more accurate picture of what's happening in the electric grid.
Well, it's sort of like there's this great lake of electricity out there that we're taking our energy from. And the dimensions of the lake is a lot bigger than you'd think. I live in Washington, D.C., and yes, there's a power plant up the Potomac River a little ways. But my electricity may come from Pennsylvania or West Virginia, Ohio, because all these generating stations are pouring into the big lake. And the load centers, the cities in the electricity world, a load center is what you call a city. The grid that I'm tapped into goes all the way out to beyond the Mississippi River. And there is not a single grid. There's actually 3 different grids in the United States. There's Eastern, Western, and Texas, of all things.
So there literally are 3 different grids that aren't connected and don't share power among each other.
They're connected very slightly, but by and large, they're 3 independent grids. And within one of these grids, there are these regional transmission groups that might cover, you know, 10, 12 states. So, for example, I'm linked here in D.C. to the PJM interconnection, which is I actually got a chance to visit the headquarters in a bunker in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania. You drive down a lonely country road, and then suddenly you come to this heavily fortified building surrounded with high security fences, and you go in and you sign in, you go down an elevator, and there's a bunker there and all these big flashing lights. It's like that old movie War Games, you know. It is a Cold War artifact, this bunker. It was built to withstand a nuclear missile strike, but that's where they run one of the major transmission networks in the eastern grid.
Now, is there any national authority which governs the grid, or are there 4 or 5 regional grids or hundreds of smaller ones? How are these things governed and interconnected?
The states individually control the transmission lines, which is something that the power companies were bending my ear about. They would like it if the federal government exerted more authority and took some of the power away from the states to decide about whether or not you could have a transmission line, you know, across a particular state, because they look at the country differently than we look at it. They don't see the state lines. They see, okay, the load centers are over here in the east, the generating stations, you know, the power stations, you know, burning massive amounts of coal, or along the Ohio River Valley or West Virginia or so on. They want to get that electricity from west to east, and it can be irritating to have to go through the permitting process of every county and every state government. One company was telling me that they spent 18 years building a new power line, but only 18 months of actual construction. It was 16 and a half years of getting the permission to do it.
Now, you're right in this. Actually, I think you quote another expert as saying that the grid is mostly built on 1960s technology. What does that mean? What's its significance?
Well, it's just, you know, some of it is dates back many, many decades. And the goal, what people would like to do, is create a smart grid, a grid that's not just electricity going down a line a wire that has no information coming back. Those power lines that go to your house, they're not like, you know, broadband cable or something. It's, you know, there's no data going on that. And the power company typically does not know how much electricity I'm using unless they send a meter reader to come and look at a meter on the side of my house. You know, when are we going to bring this into the 21st century? So the goal is to come up with smart meters that actually transmit information back to the utility company. So the companies would actually know who's using power when. And ultimately, you might have a system in which you could control both the supply of electricity, but also the demand of it. You could have demand management.
So a lot of us have these meters that have these little dials and don't do anything but measure how much we're using. If we had smarter meters and a smarter grid, how would that help? How would that allow us to more efficiently manage our energy?
Well, for example, when it's really hot like it is today, the power companies have to start up these low-efficiency auxiliary generating plants. And essentially, electricity costs more on really hot days like this. See, right now, it's all about supply. It's all about just generate more power and try to meet the demand. If you can actually manage the demand, then you wouldn't have to necessarily run those auxiliary power plants that are very low efficiency. The idea of a smart grid is one that the term is thrown around, but the gist of it also is that right now the system is vulnerable to blackouts because people have to literally throw a switch or figure out where the power is going in any given moment. It's not nearly as automated as it needs to be. It needs to go up by a factor of 10 or a factor of 100 to be more automated so that the grid will sense when there is too much or too little power on one of the lines. Like what happened in 2003 with the big blackout in New York is you had a set of cascading failures that began in Ohio. First, you had a power plant goes out and ceases to generate electricity. And then a whole bunch of electricity starts pouring into northeastern Ohio, overheats some of these 345 kilovolt transmission lines, which begin to sag because when these lines get hot, they sag. They made contact with trees. They shorted out. Suddenly, you have all this electricity with no place to go. And eventually, you had several hundred power plants shut down, and 50 million people were suddenly without electricity. In New York City, for example, it took a day and a half to get it back online. So you have a system there that's just not very robust. It doesn't really sort of meet our modern standards of technology.
Let's go back to something we were talking about a moment ago. We all have heard that in the hottest days of summers, and sometimes when there's a particularly bitterly cold day in winter, the power companies are concerned about these peak usage moments at which the system might be overstressed. And I guess what we can infer from that is that the grid doesn't store much power. It pretty much generates what's needed at the moment, I guess, which is why if we're all using too much at the same time, we create a stress that a smarter grid might not experience, right?
One of the dreams is to find a way to park electricity. I mean, right now it's hard to store it. I mean, one thing you can do is you can pump water uphill at night when there's low demand for electricity. You can pump the water up to the top of the hill, and that effectively works as a battery because then the next day during the daytime when there's a lot of demand, the water flows back down the hill and turns the turbine. But in general, they don't have batteries for electricity that are anything like what you'd want to be able to store it in great quantity. I think the city of Fairbanks, Alaska, has a big battery the size of a football field. I think that sets the record right now.
Seriously? The size of a football field?
That's what I have not been there. That is what I am told. The dream someday is when we all have electric cars, that the cars collectively can act as a kind of a battery, a storage battery for electricity, because we'll be all plugged into the grid, and when there's a real need for it, they can actually pull electricity out of the parked cars. I think right now how many electric cars are there? Not very many. And so our energy future is going to – there's no single magic bullet for it. But one piece of it is you have to have a better grid, a grid that can control the flow of electricity much better than the one we have right now, which is – essentially the old model from 60, 70 years ago, which is just crank up a big coal-powered plant and pump it into that lake, and that's it. It's a very simple system. Now, when I went to the PJM interconnect, keeping it all calibrated is not simple. I mean, you have to try to keep the supply and demand exactly balanced so you don't wind up with a situation where you have too much juice on the lines and that can damage sensitive equipment and computers and things like that, and you don't want it to dip too much either.
If we had smarter meters, not ones that just measured how much we were using, but ones which actually transmitted data back to the utility company, and a smarter electric grid, how would it be different? How would we use electricity differently? How would they supply it differently? How would we manage peak electric demand differently?
Well, you'd be able to use electricity when electricity is cheaper, off-peak hours. You'd be able to generate your own electricity from your car battery, if you have your electric car, for example, or you could your rooftop solar panel or your windmill in your backyard, and you'd be able to essentially be a producer as well as a consumer of electricity. And you'd have more information at your fingertips about, you know, how much electricity am I using? How efficient am I being, you know, from day to day, week to week? I mean, right now you have this sort of dumb meter on the side of the house that someone comes by and reads it, which is, you know, it's not really a 21st century technology.
So right now I don't know any better than to run my dishwasher when everybody else has their air conditioners on. And so the power companies, which can't store much power, puts up all their old cranky auxiliary stuff, and that's much more expensive to produce. If all this data was flowing back between me and the electric company, it would what? They would give me different rates per kilowatt hour depending on the time of day, or I would have a display
telling me when it's cheap? They might say, you know, right now it's 20 cents an hour. Maybe you want to wait till it drops down to 5 cents an hour. They might say, you know, because of all the air conditioners that are running right now because it's so hot outside, that we are charging X amount for electricity. If you wait 3 hours when the sun starts to go down, we will drop that rate in half. And you're empowered to make a decision based on the real cost of electricity, because you're right. When they have to really crank the electricity at the peak level, they bring on these really inefficient, typically coal-powered plants that they're the opposite of being, you know, a green energy source. So it's a win-win situation. You can save money, and it's environmentally a better way to go.
We have all these power companies. Many of them are investor-owned. They have, you know, shareholders they have to pay attention to in their bottom lines. Other of them are public. But they're regulated generally on a state-by-state basis, and you have this national impetus to upgrade the grid, to make it smarter. But every decision has to be reviewed by state regulators. In fact, there was recently one, I believe, in Maryland where even though a Baltimore utility had gotten a big grant from the Department of Energy to put in smart meters, the state regulators looked at it and said, we're not sure this investment is worth it. Is there a national effort to kind of bring some order here and establish a real sense of priority, saying, you know, we it's important for all of us that we make these improvements?
I would say that this is all something that the Obama administration is looking at this, the Congress is looking at it, but it remains sort of a local state regulated system. The grid is something that's been kind of cobbled together over time. It's ungainly, it's not pretty, but somehow it works. It's a little bit here, a little bit there. It kind of gradually evolved. If you had to start it all over again, you wouldn't build it this way necessarily. But it's been 130 years in the making, and it's not going to suddenly be just erased overnight. I mean, the future of the grid is going to be similar to what we've seen in the past, which is you add a little bit here, add a little bit there. Lots of different players get to make a decision. And no, Dave, it's not going to be just, you know, the federal government come in and say, this is how we're going to do it. It's going to be much more of a community-by-community decision.
Well, Joel Achenbach, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Great, Dave. Thank you.
Joel Achenbach spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Achenbach's article on fixing the electric grid is in the July edition of the National Geographic. You'll find a link to it on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you'll also find a visualization of the U.S. energy grid. Until now, Stephanie Finch has been known primarily for her backup work with the band The Mission Express, fronted by her husband, the guitarist and producer Chuck Prophet. But with her new album, Cry Tomorrow, and her own backup band called The Company Men, rock critic Ken Tucker says Finch has come into her own.
Stephanie Finch sings in a high, plaintive register that can sound both pleading and firm, sarcastic and wry. It's a voice of knowingness from which innocence has been stripped away to reveal a performer who knows what she wants from herself and from other people. Many of Finch's songs, she wrote 6 of the 10 on this album, are guided as much by keyboard and guitar riffs as by her singing. This song uses a simple, insistent guitar hook that recalls the Velvet Underground or Jonathan Richman's Modern Lovers. It has the power of simplicity on Tina Goodbye. Produced this album with Finch. They happen to be married. Prophet used to be in the band Green on Red and is part of Finch's group The Company Men. He's produced first-rate albums for singer-songwriters as various as Alejandro Escovedo and Kelly Willis. On Finch's album Cry Tomorrow, she covers a song that Prophet wrote for Escovedo called Sensitive Boys. Escovedo sang the song plaintively, as though sensitivity was a burden. Finch takes the song and makes it a sharp-eyed, tough-minded critique of boys who fancy themselves to be sensitive.
Sensitive boys, insensitive clothes, sensitive words, wrapped up in sensitive poems, big dreamy eyes, long French sleeves, shivering in the cold light of the New York City heat. Sensitive boys, here they come.
Here they come, watch them run.
Another superb song covered by Finch on this album is Count the Days 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, written and recorded in the 1960s by the brother and sister soul act Charlie and Inez Fox. Finch and Prophet rearranged the song, slowing it down and turning it into something else entirely. Where Charlie and Inez Fox sang Count the Days as a proclamation of romantic freedom, Stephanie Finch turns the tune into more of a threat that says, you'll be counting the days after I leave you. You will suffer when I'm gone. And it's all the more effectively devastating when sung in such a hauntingly matter-of-fact manner.
If you believe I'm leaving, count the days I'm gone. If you don't believe I'm leaving, count the days I'm gone.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
I gave you my heart, you gave me her. I gave you sugar, you gave me dirt. You said that I wouldn't have the nerve to leave, and if I did, I'd be the one to grieve. Well, if you don't.
There's a nice avoidance of singer-songwriter confessionalism throughout Cry Tomorrow. And the album title is apt. Stephanie Finch may cry tomorrow, but right now she's going to lay it all out for you, the good and the bad stuff that precedes any crying. And besides, who says she's the one who's going to be the one in tears when she gets finished with you?
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Cry Tomorrow from Stephanie Finch and the Company Men. You can hear several tracks from the album on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.